Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It is a special pledge edition of the Florida Roundup. Our pledge lines remain open throughout the program at 1-866-247-9576, 866-247-9576, or of course online as well on the website wlrnradio.org. Chris Bird is a lawyer. 3 years ago, he was working for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. There was a new governor elected, and Bird was called to a staff meeting with his boss, Larry Morgan.
And during this meeting, Mr. Morgan gave us somewhat of a warning to beware of the words climate change, sustainability, and sea level rise, and advise us not to use those words in particular within the new administration.
This week, the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, WLRN, and the Miami Herald reported several former Department of Environmental Protection insiders, contractors, and volunteers say the department ordered them not to use those phrases, climate change and global warming. The department is responsible for, quote, protecting our air, water, and land, according to its state website. Now, Governor Rick Scott has infamously said he's not a scientist when asked about climate change. In Hialeah this week, Governor Scott denied his Environmental Protection Department was banned from using those terms. He did not address directly whether his administration considers global warming and climate change to be real, though.
Is global warming a problem?
Well, here's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the problems of Florida. We're dealing with beach renourishment, flood mitigation, dealing with making sure we push water south. We have the right storage things for the Everglades. We're doing all these things.
Now, we asked the Department of Environmental Protection for an interview and response. The department referred to its previous denials this week that there is not an unwritten policy banning these phrases, climate change and global warming. Chris Bird, the former lawyer with the department, he stands behind his charge.
The people of the state of Florida deserve a state government that is rooted in science, and that has a Department of Environmental Protection that is not censored from using certain words and can address the real-time environmental issues that Florida faces today.
So who do you believe, the governor or the whistleblowers? Should Florida's Department of Environmental Protection have an official policy about using the phrase climate change or global warming, or not using those phrases in official state policy? What's at stake over a state agency uttering two phrases or not? Let us know on Twitter today, at WLRN, on Facebook, or, of course, online on our website at WLRN.org. Tristram Corton is with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting behind this expansive investigation. Craig Pittman is environmental reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. And Tanya Lewis is a reporter with Live Science joining us from New York City. Tristram, let's begin here. No official policy banning these phrases in writing. What kind of evidence did you find, however?
We talked to several employees, contractors, and volunteers who all said they were verbally told not to use the term climate change or global warming. There were other terms they were told not to use, too, but those cropped up, and some didn't hear them uniformly, such as sea level rise, which the state is using that term now. Sustainability is another one, but definitely climate change and global warming. Several people on the record. We also pointed out reports that showed the Florida Coastal Council report in the year before Scott was elected had a whole section on climate change and how to address it, and that it was an urgent research priority. And then in the latest issue, it's only mentioned if it's in the title of a past report.
You found documents within the Florida Department of Environmental Protection prior to Governor Scott's administration, which focused on climate change and global warming and the threat it poses to Florida. Those sections did not continue with the same agency under the new Scott administration.
Well, what we found, just recently we did a data search of the DEP website of PDFs, because the PDFs are dated, and those are in the form of memos, reports.
Mm-hmm. What'd you find with that
memorandums?
Search?
And so the year before Scott was elected, there were 209 references to climate change in the DEP website, and it declines precipitously from there. Every year there's a few a few mentions, but it's less and less and less. This year, none so far. Last year, there were 34 references, and they were all from other agencies that had submitted reports.
And so taken together, the insiders, the volunteers, the contractors, your document search, is there a causation here, or is it just a matter of inferred correlation?
You mean, explain that.
In terms of whether or not this was caused by an unofficial, a nonverbal policy by the change of administration in Tallahassee, or that the issue is being addressed?
Okay, so, well, one of the DEP employees who told us about being briefed on this said that at the end of the briefing, her manager said, this is the will of the governor and we're the governor's agency. Clearly something's going on, and it's coming, and it's top down. It's not bottom up.
Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times, you've covered environmental policy in the state for a good long time. This agency reports directly to the governor. This, as Tristram says, goes directly to the governor. What's your experience in your read on this debate that's been blown wide open about whether or not there's a nonverbal policy about using these phrases by the top environmental protection agency in the state of Florida?
One of the things that I've found in doing stories about the Department of Environmental Protection is that oftentimes things are going on there that nobody puts in writing. They know about it, but they don't put it in writing. For instance, there was a strong push going on during the governor's first administration to cut back on the amount of time for issuing permits for pollution and for paving over wetlands. And the only real documentation we were able to find to show that was a videotape of the governor standing in front of DEP employees congratulating them on cutting the permitting time down to a mere 2 days. It had been 45 days under Governor Bush. So there are things that they pursue, and they know that under the Government in the Sunshine Law, written records would have to be turned over to the press and exposed to the public. And so a lot of things are not done in writing.
Craig, so in other words, your thoughts on a systemic essentially policy to utter nonverbal, non-written guidance for environmental protection officers?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, is that there are policies that are put in place that are not communicated by writing, because that way you keep it from becoming public, but everybody knows about it.
Tanya Lewis with Live Science, Florida is not alone in its reported effort to not utter certain phrases when it comes to climate science, is it?
No. In fact, a number of other states have actually passed laws that attempt to limit the influence of climate change on policymaking. For example, in 2012, North Carolina actually passed a law that banned the state from basing its coastal policies on some of the latest predictions of sea level rise for the state. There was a prediction by the Coastal Resources Commission that said that sea levels would rise by as much as 39 inches, or just over 3 feet, in the next century, which could affect insurance rates in the region and coastal development. So,
and we found the Army Corps of Engineers, which of course is a federal agency very focused on infrastructure and science, Tanya, we've done reporting at WLRN that has found they do consider sea level rise in some types of coastal projects. That's a federal agency, not a state agency, but you're finding evidence of some coastal states that have essentially banned the use of the latest climate science when it comes to policy?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I think it's probably on a state-by-state basis, but North Carolina's not alone. I mean, Louisiana and Tennessee, for example, have both passed a law that allows teachers to actually present alternative theories to climate change as well as evolution. So basically just casting some doubt on the established climate science that the majority of climate scientists agree on, of human-caused climate change.
Anthropomorphic influence is another phrase that some have used when it comes to global warming and climate change. Tanya Lewis is a reporter with Live Science with us, Craig Pittman, environmental reporter for Tampa Bay Times, and Tristram Corton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. This is a Pledge special of the Florida Roundup. You can join the conversation on Twitter, social media, at WLRN, on our Facebook page, as well as on our website at WLRN.org. Tristram, when the governor's office flatly denies having this unwritten policy and says that it's not true, your response and the response from the insiders that have claimed that there is this unwritten policy? I mean, what is the public supposed to make of this essentially he said, they said debate?
Yeah. I don't know. What is he denying? He's denying that there's a policy, which is probably technically accurate. There's nothing in writing about this. Is he denying? So is he saying that they're lying? Is he saying, I'm making this up? I don't know. He's very terse with his words, he and his staff. They just use this one thing. There is no policy. It's not true. It's very simple. I'd love to know more.
Craig, what do you think? I mean, when the governor denies that there is an unwritten policy, I mean, there are semantics involved here, but it's worth spending a little bit of time. What do you think the intent and the purpose or the intent and the meaning of that denial is?
I think the governor's intent is to say, I had nothing to do with whatever's going on there. Sort of like his role in the firing of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement chief, where he kind of threw his cabinet aides under the bus for that one. The governor, though, the climate change issue is one that's really sticky for him, and he has done his absolute best to avoid talking about it at all costs. Whenever he said, I'm not a scientist, we had climate scientists who said, we'd love to come talk to you about it and explain to you the science, and so he met with them. Somewhat reluctantly, sat with them for about 20-30 minutes, didn't even say anything to them about okay, you've convinced me, and instead just said, I want to focus on solutions, and that was it. And since then, he has not taken any position at all. When he was at Port Manatee this week, and reporters were asking him about climate change, do you think climate change is a serious problem for Florida? He ended the press gaggle immediately and walked off.
Yeah. You know what's frustrating me about the denial is it's all not true. So if there's this evidence, right, people are saying this. He's calling them all liars. There is this documentary evidence that we've uncovered in a data search. And, you know, that's not manipulable.
The documents exist.
The documents, or don't exist, as the case may be.
Well, you did find evidence. You found documentary evidence prior to the Scott administration and after he was inaugurated.
So what's frustrating is, you know, and a little suspicious, I'll have to say, is he says, this isn't true, there's no policy. It seems to me a more honest one would be, look, I had nothing to do with this, I will look into it. You know, why not do that? Frankly, I'd really love to get those answers. You know, I hope somebody in the legislature holds a committee hearing or something to try and talk to the people who are in charge and find out what's going on.
Well, and the interesting thing is that, you know, these kind of incidents like this help to paint this picture of Florida as not the Sunshine State, but the Punchline State. I mean, you know, the late night comics are making jokes about it. It's in editorial cartoons and so forth. One that I saw had Governor Scott saying, I'm not a scientist, however, I am a linguist. And then displaying his list of words you're not supposed to say.
Comedy Central.
Comedy Central talking about, if you're going to ban two-word phrases from Florida, why not lap dance and meth lab? Climate change is something more of a serious problem in a state that's flatter than Kansas.
Well, Craig, I want to say that, you know, I was talking to the guy at PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, and he was saying, It bemused him that this had reached such a crescendo because everybody's known this has been going on for years. And it's true. If you had been reading Craig's articles over the years, you'd know that there was really shady stuff going on at the DEP. And, you know, just people didn't care. It was a state agency. Somehow this hit, so, you know, who knows those metrics that things blow up on.
Let's get outside of Florida and a little, you know, the fish are seeing the water as we're in the Sunshine State. Tanya Lewis, you've covered this issue from a national perspective. You know, give us that impression that this story has made well beyond the shores of Florida. We've seen this obviously picked up in the national and international media, in addition, of course, to the late night comics and the cable comics as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reach of this kind of a story is pretty clear. You know, here in New York, people were talking about it. It's definitely something that is not just happening at the level of Florida alone. A number of states, you know, largely controlled by the GOP in the legislature, have passed similar laws. And in fact, five other states beyond North Carolina, Louisiana, and Tennessee have actually considered legislation that would try to, you know, limit or prevent climate science from entering the discussions at the policy level.
And has that had any early effect as those laws have been passed in those states? Or you know, what has been the impact of those laws? Is it too early to tell, or is there any kind of ripple effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is probably too early to see, but maybe in some areas, some states obviously are already seeing the effects of climate change and sea level rise. In North Carolina, for example, the U.S. Geological Survey is predicting that basically or that whole corridor from North Carolina up to Massachusetts could expect to see 3 to 4 times the sea level rise that's happening worldwide. Yeah, we're definitely going to be seeing the effects of climate change, and if the policies don't keep up with that, then that could be a problem.
Yeah, you know, so what's gratifying about the exposure the story is getting is that Governor Scott has a pattern of just denying something and moving on. And you know what? After a while, he wins because the press has to move on to other issues. Mm. This one seems to have, you know, gotten such attention and has reached such a crescendo. It's not going away. I don't think it's going away anytime soon.
What about the engagement on the part of federal agencies? South Florida particularly has had a municipal interest in climate change, sea level rise particularly. There is a sea level rise task force in Miami-Dade County. There's the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact, which is an agreement between Monroe, Miami-Dade, right, Broward, and Palm Beach, which is seen as really a leading municipal government effort toward the addressing of reinforcement, right, of climate change. But these local governments clearly are not going to do anything about national energy policy, right, those kinds of things. So the engagement from the federal government has been what last week?
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say that the clearly with the state not leading, municipalities are left on their own to grapple with this, and that's rather unfortunate.
But this particular story has resonated with the Obama cabinet members and former national,
right,
leaders. We,
yeah,
have,
yeah,
seen that, Tristan,
yeah, yeah,
haven't we?
Well, you know, Al Gore tweeted it and John Kerry mentioned it yesterday, which prompted a whole other news story.
But Craig Pittman, I mean, just recently in an issue of, I think it was Rolling Stone, as well as in an op-ed in the Miami Herald within the past couple of weeks, there have been current and former Defense Department officials calling climate change and global warming a national security issue.
Yes, it is, certainly. And I mean, it touches on a whole host of things that we all care about, from food supply to national security to water availability. And the thing you have to bear in mind, too, is that the most recent report from the government in terms of our climate change vulnerability pinpointed Florida in particular, yeah, as being vulnerable to the effects of climate change, and not just from sea level rise, which of course is the biggie for a lot of coastal areas, but also in terms of spreading of mosquito-borne diseases and other issues. So it's clearly a big problem for the world, but it's also a really particularly big problem for Florida, and and in so many different ways. For instance, the Turkey Point nuclear plant is right there on the water.
That's
with,
right,
the rising sea.
Sure.
You know, is that really a good place for a nuclear plant anymore? So those are all issues that the state government is not dealing with, not talking about. They want to leave it alone, leaving the municipalities to grapple with it from the terms of, well, we can't prevent it, but at least we can try to adapt to it. And so that's their focus. And we do have, we would be wrong to neglect mentioning Florida's university systems have stepped up, and they are doing a lot of work in regards to climate change,
sure,
research and so forth as,
sure,
well.
And we should say they do have a state government funding mechanism in there.
Yes.
So that, you know, some of that money does flow through Tallahassee that arguably could be,
right,
fungible for some of those academic,
right,
activities.
Well, and that's sort of the way the federal government is having some small influence on the state government. I did a story recently about how the Florida Department of Health was giving grant money,
yeah,
to people to study the health effects of climate change in their communities. They were getting this money from the EPA, so it's federal funding being funneled through the state, and in that case, the state has to talk about climate change. But when I interviewed someone from the department about it, she very carefully picked her words so she never mentioned,
right,
those two verboten phrases. Yes,
I used that story in my second day, yeah, piece. And so all these agencies, and when I contacted, we did another story in which an individual from the Department of Transportation talked,
right,
on the record about a briefing, and there's just a couple of incidents at the Department of Health, Craig's story, and a scientist who had her paper censored.
We had been told a year and a half ago from the Department of Transportation from the state level that sea level rise planning when it came to state transportation infrastructure was a local issue.
Well, so what, for a coastal state. What these guys, yeah, that's crazy. What these guys were saying to me when I go to them for comment is, first of all, it's not true, the same line. But then they're all saying, we're working on sea level rise. We're doing stuff. And it's true. They all have a little task force to deal with their wedge of the issue. But they can't call them climate change task force. So the question remains, are they, how effective are they if they can't address this openly and honestly?
Tanya Lewis, from outside Florida, clearly a canary in the coal mine here at elevation zero in South Florida when it comes to sea level rise, but obviously climate change and global warming science has shown that there's a number of different effects here. When you look and cover this issue nationally, what is that engagement on the federal level to the state level, and why is it the way that it is?
I guess I'm not quite sure what.
So we're seeing a lot of local engagement here in South Florida, driven by municipalities, and the vacuum of leadership on the state level is exemplified by this possible nonverbal warning not to use these phrases. You've talked about five other states talking about, you know, banning certain phrases or considerations when it comes to discussing these things, even an education level. So what about the federal leadership here?
I guess to be honest, I'm not super familiar with exactly what's coming down on the federal level, but I think in general, you know, we have the government and other of the United States and other countries convene these annual panels to discuss the effects of climate change, and they have experts coming from all areas of climate science and the physical sciences, and all of these reports have consistently been coming back saying that, you know, climate change is real and that we need to do something about it. And I think unless we see a concerted effort from the federal level, it's going to be tough to kind of address these issues, especially state by state, especially some of the coastal states, like not just Florida, but along the whole eastern seaboard. Mm-hmm. As we saw with things like Hurricane Sandy that just kind of came out of nowhere, and we need to be prepared for more of those kinds of things in future.
Yeah, I think on the federal level, certainly this administration is pretty vocal about climate change, global warming, and the need to prepare for it. There's obviously a lot of resistance in Congress, and that muddies things. But it's when you talk about the federal agencies, I was talking to a guy at one of these federal agencies off the record, and I was telling him the story I was working on, and he said, been there, done that. And he was referring to the George Bush years when they were told not to use the term climate change throughout the NOAA, in their reports as well.
Craig, I want to ask you about the politics here of this. The state legislative session is underway. Tristram's story comes out. Will there be any hearings, any legislative engagement on this particular issue?
Well, it's funny you should ask. There was a committee hearing just this week in regards to the EPA's new rules on pollution, CO2 pollution. And one of the legislators actually commented that he didn't understand how carbon dioxide could be considered a pollutant because God gave us carbon dioxide to help the plants grow.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you're going to find I really don't think you're going to find anyone in the legislature to hold a hearing to question the governor about his standing on climate change and whether he thinks that's a viable scientific theory. More likely it's something that the voters need to bring up with their representatives and with the governor. And, you know, we have seen in the past that the governor does respond when the voters give him a real clear signal about something. When he was all in favor of putting more privatization in the state park system and putting more, letting RVs camp in places like Honeymoon Island State Park where they have no camping at all, they had 1,000 people turn out at a public hearing, and the governor immediately backpedaled off the whole thing and said, that's it, we're going to end the whole idea. So when the people lead, the leaders follow.
Finally, Tristram, the implications here for environmental policy for the state of Florida are what? As your reporting continues on this, as you've heard from more folks from inside the department and outside the department that have talked about similar stories about the nonverbal linguistic language rules that may be a play at the Department of Environmental Protection, and we hear lack of engagement from Tallahassee. What potential direction does this shape for Florida's environmental protection policy?
Right. So that's what we need to find out. Was this just semantics? Don't use this word, but do everything you can to address this issue in a substantive way.
And the governor talked about beach restoration and these other issues that he did want to talk about, and how they're addressing some challenges without saying the challenge.
Right. But, I mean, the challenges are much more significant than beach restoration and a sewage plant in the Keys, which is what he's touting.
Right.
They involve, you know, beefing up seawalls, raising roads, more floodgates, et cetera, et cetera. So is there money there for that? I mean, my early look into this is, I mean, I know a lot of programs that have been cut, and a lot of the people I've talked to said they feel they cannot, you know, make a lot of noise with these issues that they're studying because they don't want to bring attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. So it has to do with climate change.
Tristram Corton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting behind the blockbuster story this week regarding the allegations of a nonverbal policy at the Florida Department of Environmental Protections banning the phrases climate change and global warming. You can find that story on our website at WLRN.org. Craig Pittman with the Tampa Bay Times, longtime environmental reporter from Tampa Bay. Always great to hear from you, Craig. And Tanya Lewis covering the environment for Live Science with us in New York City. Tanya, thank you so much for your contribution as well. This is a special pledge edition of the Florida Roundup. The pledge lines are open at 866-247-9576, 866-247-9576. Still to come on our program, corruption and Florida prisons, not inside the jail cells, but from the jailers. Back on a pledge special edition of the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for pledging. Those lines are open at 866-247-9576. The pledge line, 866-247-9576. Online as well, safe and secure at WLRNradio.org. The Florida Department of Corrections has been under growing scrutiny for months now since the Miami Herald uncovered several prisoner deaths under suspicious circumstances. There have been three bosses at the agency in the past 6 months, nine in the past 9 years. And this week, Florida lawmakers in Tallahassee heard from several correction veterans telling stories of corruption and cover-up by high-ranking prison officials. John Ulm is a law enforcement veteran who's worked in prisons and now works in the Inspector General's office.
We need some oversight. The organized crimes, the murders, the assaults, the victimization that goes on there every day is horrendous. I say we're broken. That's only John's opinion.
Gulf County Sheriff Mike Harrison used to work as a corrections investigator. He testified that investigators were told to handle investigation cases administratively, the result being that someone may be fired but not charged criminally.
That tend to be the direction that the department wanted investigators to go into, not on the criminal route, but to go on the administrative route to make it look favorable upon the department that the person was gone and that no criminal charges were filed. A criminal charge is filed on a high-ranking colonel or a warden or an assistant warden would obviously be a black eye on DOC.
DOC, the Department of Corrections, Doug Gilson still works in the DOC's Inspector General's office. He also told lawmakers of one case in which the target of his investigation had to approve of the very same investigation.
I received a call from upper management Inspector General's office that everything we needed to get or obtain any information, we needed to go through the very person that had been named as a subject. Inspectors, investigators are supposed to have unfettered access to documentation, to talk to who we want. But now we're being told specifically you'll go through this person who's been named as a subject.
Gilson is part of a lawsuit alleging he and other inspectors who have spoken out were denied whistleblower status. They also claim they've been targeted for retaliation for speaking out about the death of an inmate allegedly after being sprayed with chemicals by prison guards. Now, that lawsuit was thrown out by a federal judge last week. That decision is being appealed. Julie K. Brown is the investigative reporter behind the prison series with the Miami Herald. She's with us here in our studios. Some disturbing testimony that lawmakers heard this week from these law enforcement veterans. Murders in prison, deaths in prison, cover-ups. What stood out to you as you've followed this story for the past 9 months or so?
Well, I have known about all this, obviously, for quite a long time. I have read the lawsuits, and I've also heard from other inspectors and other people in the prison system who have told me horrific stories similar to this. There's a couple things that stood out. Number one, this is the first time that they testified publicly, and they did so at the threat of retaliation, which they did bring up, the fact that they have been retaliated against. John Alden, for example, 4 days after we printed the story about the fact that they were filing this whistleblower suit, they told him basically, clean out your office. We're transferring you. We're giving you a pay cut. And they, of course, tried to backtrack on that, say, we never said that, because, you know, when it came out in the paper, they wanted to sort of cover themselves. So it didn't happen. But the bottom line is that they did this. They have no real agenda to do this because they're risking their careers, their pensions, their families.
The veterans we heard testify essentially against their own agency, really. Yeah.
Number one. And number two, the fact that Julie Jones, the new secretary, I understand from people who were there, walked out on this testimony before they really got started. And I just think whether she had something important to do or not, it sort of doesn't look good that she wasn't even willing to listen to what they had to say. And she also had made statements to the fact that she sort of said, well, these are just a bunch of disgruntled inspectors who just want to be cops and are FDLE agents, and which is ridiculous, because first of all, the Gulf County Sheriff who testified, he is a sheriff.
He's no longer with the agency.
He has no reason to do something like
this. The secretary has also said many of the stories that were told were happening years ago. They were old stories, old news, and they'd been taken care of. Well, maybe not taken care of, but they were old news.
Well, first of all, that's not true. Some of these cases weren't old news, and the bottom line. And number two, let's just say they are old news. Let's just say she's correct. What difference does it make?
Does that justify the allegations?
If someone is killed, if a corrections officer is an abusive officer, and he, you know, put someone in a shower and let them sit there and die in 180 degree temperatures, does that mean because the case is old, we say, okay, we're not going to worry about it?
And that's
anymore?
The allegations regarding the death of
Darren Rainey
in the South Dade Correctional Facility in Homestead, right?
That's correct.
I want to talk a little bit about this retaliation accusation and the stories that you have told. We had heard that prior to the legislative session, that agency officers were requested to sign confidentiality agreements. What do you know about that?
Well, I know that that it put a fear in them. It really scared them. I mean, they're very scared. There's a lot of people who had been contacting not only me, but, for example, other people within the Department of Corrections and other people outside. There's a lot of groups, conservative. That's what's interesting about this whole issue. This is a bipartisan issue. This isn't an issue of a bunch of liberals on the side of prisoner rights. This goes across the board. These are conservative Christian groups, the ACLU, who all agree that this prison system is in a crisis. It's out of control. So to try to gag anyone and to try to prevent anyone from saying, here's what the problem is, it looks bad for everyone who is advocating that the system needs to be fixed.
The system needs to be fixed. We heard the testimony this week. We played some comments just now from some of those law enforcement veterans that had been part of the agency. Some of them still are part of the agency. We've seen visits on the part of legislators to prisons that have taken upon themselves to investigate the physical plant and have seen the leaky roofs and the dilapidated conditions of these prisons, and to some degree even unsafe conditions, not physically unsafe, but in terms of the potential for an escape. With all that's on the agenda in the next 45 days in Tallahassee, what's the next step after this? Will we hear from the secretary herself in front of a House or Senate committee?
I mean, that remains to be seen. I've been hearing mixed thoughts of it. There isn't a whole lot of time. I don't know how much political capital that these senators and representatives, these other lawmakers, really want to put into this at this point.
Let me ask it this way, then. Is there a plan being formulated somewhere to address the systemic problems that you have documented within the pages of the Miami Herald with your investigation that we heard this week in front of this Judiciary Committee, the Judicial Committee?
Sadly, I really don't see a whole lot. I mean, there's been a couple bills that have been proposed. We'll see where they go. But historically, this has happened in the past, and it all goes back to business as usual. The issue here, though, is I think we've kind of peeled a layer of an onion here on something that they're not going to be able to put back on, because there's too many people now that are upset. There's a lot of people, like I said, on both sides of the political aisle who have constituents, who have family members, sons, daughters, brothers, sisters who are in this prison system, and they're in there for things that are, you know, forging checks.
A nonviolent crime.
You know, there's a good deal of people in that prison system who are in there for nonviolent crimes, and they're being tortured the same as someone who is a serial killer, practically.
It's 101,000 prisoners inside the Florida Department of Corrections system from the Panhandle to the Peninsula. Julie K. Brown, investigative reporter with the Miami Herald. The governor has proposed spending more money in this budget cycle. There doesn't seem to be much resistance, given, again, the documentation that you have provided regarding some of these conditions. Beyond the dollars, the question is going to be, how will they be spent, and spent to address some of these systemic problems of allegations of corruption from inside the jail, from the jailers?
I think the most distressing part that I'm seeing right now about it is that the secretary, this new secretary, seems to not understand. And I'm not just saying that from my perspective. I've been talking to other people who are on the front lines of what's going on within the department. And there's a feeling within the department, and there's a feeling within people who are interested in reform, that she does not really grasp the problem with the culture and how to fix this culture of violence and corruption in the system.
Is there a Department of Justice role in this?
Yes, they are already involved in it. They are closely watching it. They're actively involved in several specific cases within specific prisons, but they're also keeping a very close eye on the whole overall problem.
That's the question here, is right? They're case by case, they've gotten involved or are watching closely. But as you've detailed, and as again we've heard in the testimony, some systemic questions here regarding the culture. Is there a future role that the Department of Justice is actively considering?
Yes, there is. They are looking at it, and they are talking to people, FDLE, the state attorneys around the country. They are monitoring whether there is a pattern or practice of civil rights violations in the Florida prison system.
Julie K. Brown, investigative reporter following the prison system for the Miami Herald. Always a pleasure, Julie. Thanks for sharing your reports with us. Well, this is a special pledge edition here of the Florida Roundup. Those pledge lines remain open at 866-247-9576. Please support WLRN Public Radio and the Florida Roundup at 866-247-9576. Still to come, the family business of politics in Miami, and laying blame for Florida's public school testing troubles. We're back on a special pledge edition of the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening, and thanks for pledging and supporting public radio. You can do that now at 866-247-9576. 1-866-247-9576. Safe and secure online at WLRNradio.org. The national political story continues to be focused on the son and brother of former presidents, and then the wife of another. But in Miami, it's the daughter of a mayor challenging another mayor. Miami-Dade County Public School Board member Raquel Regalado is the daughter of the City of Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado. She announced this week that she will run for Miami-Dade County Mayor in 2016.
I think that a lot of the decisions that are being made at the county have more to do with who comes to visit the mayor and what ideas they have, what lobbyists bring, what proposals, as opposed to really delving deep into what are the needs of Miami-Dade County and focusing on initiatives that resolve the problems of our residents. not the problems of lobbyists that come to see the mayor.
That mayor, of course, is the current mayor, Carlos Jimenez. He is running for re-election, and Regalado is the first official challenger. Doug Hanks covers it all for County Hall, for Miami-Dade County, and the Miami Herald, joining us from the Miami Herald's newsroom. Doug, not a surprise, Regalado's candidacy. How formidable of a candidate early on will she be?
We don't know. She's going to be behind in fundraising. We know that. And we haven't seen an independent public poll on Mayor Jimenez since the summer. So, you know, you hear different prognostications from people. Some people question why she got in so early. Some people say that with her name recognition, she's got at least decent shot of being a challenger.
What about that name recognition? What about the role on the school board, her public profile? What kind of role could that play in financing? And what when we talk about the dollars at play here, how much are we talking about in this run?
She said she wants to raise needs to raise $2.5 million, which is a really big figure.
Yeah.
And Mayor Jimenez has already raised about $700,000. He's been at it for maybe 6 or 7 weeks. So certainly the money's on his side. She does have the advantage of her father's fundraising ability as the mayor of Miami. She has Norman Brayman backing her. We'll see how much money he puts into the race. But no one expects her to be able to match the incumbent's dollars.
As this campaign moves forward, what could be the impact on her current elected position on the school board of Miami-Dade County Public Schools?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people say, what has already been the impact? There was this big dispute over the value adjustment board that was really driven by her. She wanted the school board to join a lawsuit against Miami-Dade County over property tax appeals, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's complicated. And David Smiley has a story coming up this Sunday, I believe, on the complications of her father and the person she's running against, that is the mayor of Miami versus the mayor of Miami-Dade County.
So. Yeah, yeah. No, it's very complex. The narrative here reads like a novel, or certainly could read like a novel.
Yeah.
And how about that impact on the city of Miami relations with the bigger municipality in which it entirely sits, that being, of course, the county?
Yeah, I mean, that's where it gets so interesting. You really need, like, a diagram to figure it all out. But already, Mayor Jimenez and Mayor Regalado are in a big fight over bringing a tri-rail station to downtown Miami. There is litigation where Raquel Regalado is suing not only Miami-Dade County, but Miami itself over Skyrise Miami. Mm-hmm. And now we recently had the city writing back saying the suit is groundless. I mean, it gets really, really interesting.
Yeah. How crowded could this field get for Miami-Dade County Mayor?
You know, it's not a crowded field right now. There's one challenger. We know that Xavier Suarez, who's a county commissioner, is thinking about it. Other than that, I don't think you really hear any serious names out there who are A, formidable, and B, saying, yeah, I'm really looking at this.
Raquel Regalado, the first official challenger in the 2016 race for Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez as he runs for re-election. Doug Hanks covering that for the Miami Herald. Great to hear from you, Doug, of course. And we should mention that WLRN Radio is a licensee of the Miami-Dade County Public School District. Florida public school students will continue taking the Florida State Assessment Test next week. This is the test that got off to that disastrous start when thousands of students couldn't log on. Representative Manny Diaz is a Republican from Hialeah. There's the claim that it was hackers that caused this problem, cyber attacks. Representative Diaz is on the House Education Committee in Tallahassee. He spoke with Fort Myers Wink News about the cyber attacks.
There's been some sort of cyber attack, I think. We need to fully investigate it, find out if there's anything that the vendor could have done to prevent it, or if there's anything we can do to prevent it going forward.
John O'Connor covering education for State Impact and WLRN. Christina Vega doing much the same for the Miami Herald. John, what evidence do we have that the DOE is correct in pointing to cyber attacks?
Well, we have the DOE telling us this. We also have local school districts who are confirming it, saying that they saw it happening in real time last Thursday, that they got a spike in suspicious traffic. The traffic was coming
the Thursday before the Monday of tests, right?
No.
Thursday of the tests.
Yeah. So okay. Testing started a week ago Monday.
Right.
There were problems on that day. The cyber attack happened on Thursday morning, when school districts, Miami-Dade, Broward, South Florida districts, started to resume online testing.
I see.
Reported some problems in the morning, and then once they recognized that it was a cyber attack, they took some steps to mitigate it, and those problems kind of disappeared throughout the day.
So, Christina, just to be clear, two separate problems. The problems on the first day of testing had been blamed on a last-minute software update that the company behind the test was making. Then we had some challenges regarding these cyber attacks and denial-of-service attacks.
Yes, although there were some reports of scattered cyber attacks earlier in the week, and Miami-Dade says that they did see that even on days that they weren't testing. After the initial glitch, they decided not to test their kids. And on top of all of that, they also saw the cyber attacks coming.
The test results compromised in any of the cyber attacks?
Well, that's a story that I'm working on now. I mean, you have a lot of parents who just from the beginning have doubted the fairness of these tests, and now even more so.
And a lot of administrators, John, have maybe not doubted the fairness, but the validity of the first year of testing, and this just adds to that criticism.
Absolutely. And Kansas last year reported a similar cyber attack, a denial of service attack during their online testing, and they actually did a review of it and found that students who should be scoring similarly on the test scored differently, likely because of these attacks.
So worse or better?
I believe worse. Okay. That's why they threw out the results last year.
Yeah. Do we know who's behind these cyber attacks at all, Christina?
No, and they're really hard to trace. Your computer could be a part of it, and you wouldn't even know. People can buy infected computers, and it's really widespread, pretty easy and cheap to do.
Any idea in these other states if there was an organized denial of service attack?
Kansas doesn't know.
Yeah.
They've been investigating this for a year now, and they don't have an answer.
Any early warning signs? Go back 10 days. Go back 2 months. Any early warning signs of this trouble to come?
Not that I've heard of, other than we have seen it in other states before this.
Yeah. And Christina, meantime, testing is due to continue next Monday. I know I've got a test in my household of one of my children. Anxiety regarding the technological prowess of the testing system to hold up?
We've seen it run more smoothly than last week, but in speaking to people from Kansas, one of the concerns was at first they saw the attack coming from outside international IP addresses, so they were able to block them. And then the attackers were pretty persistent and came back from domestic addresses, and there was a second round of attacks. So the people who I spoke to over there were concerned that maybe we haven't seen the end of it.
And you've detailed in a story in the Herald this week about the IT department with the Miami Public Schools and other public schools. John, how robust are those information technology services to resist that kind of cyber attack if it should resume again?
Well, it depends on the school district. A district like Miami is obviously better equipped and has a deeper staff of knowledge to deal with it than maybe a more rural Florida school district would.
John, you participated in a town hall conversation in Tampa, hearing from, in Clearwater specifically, you heard from parents regarding this Florida standards assessment, concerns about the difficulty of that test. We've heard those conversations and those concerns as well leading up to the FSA testing window, which we're in right now. How validated early on have those concerns about the difficulty of the test been?
I don't know that we know. I mean, I've heard mixed results from students. Some have said this is pretty much a lot like what we had done before. Mm. Some students I've talked to have said, no, it's actually much harder. We won't really know, I think, until the next round of online testing, which is really the kind of serious revamp of the Florida standards assessments, the math, the reading.
Yeah.
These are the more interactive questions. They're going to ask more of students, supposedly. They're going to ask them to perform tasks on the computer. And that's one of the complaints I heard at the town hall this week was that, my fifth grader is going to have to take this test on a computer and he doesn't really know how to do that.
I heard that from my fourth grader that next year it's going to be on the computer and he was already a little bit concerned about it. Christina Vega with the Miami Herald, finally, we know going into this that there had been calls for a testing pause. Clearly that didn't happen. Will these tests be used in the way that they were intended to from the get-go 10 days ago?
So the Florida Department of Education so far has, they haven't decided, but it looks like they probably will be if the past is any indicator.
Christina Vega watching the public education throughout South Florida for the Miami Herald. John O'Connor doing much the same for us here on Florida Public Radio and State Impact, as well as right here on WLRN. Thanks to both of you. Finally on the roundup today. Buckle in for the Miami E-Prix. It hits the streets of downtown Miami on Saturday. It's a Grand Prix-style race, but without the roar of internal combustion engines. No mix of petroleum and oxygen. Instead, it's the high whine of electric race cars. They will run 39 laps around downtown Miami at top speeds, hitting close to 100 miles an hour. That'll do it for this edition of the Florida Roundup. It's produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Julia Duba, and Gina Jordan. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our executive producer and technical supervision today by Peter J. Maris. A Pledge special edition of South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell is next, and we're back Monday morning at 9 a.m. for a special Sunshine Economy. Basketball in business. Zoe and Magic. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.